Okay, great. So you can hear me fine? Yeah, I don't know if either of you, if you've heard me speak before today, but so yeah, I'm with One America. It's a mutual organization. It's been around for 140 years. Basically, American United Life, State Life, Pioneer Mutual. We have a reinsurance arm. We have a pension arm, BD and all that. I've been working for them for 25 years. Practiced law before that in the Indianapolis area. Before that, I was in everybody's favorite oxymoron for 16 years, military intelligence, as everybody likes to say. Grew up on a dairy farm in north central Indiana. So I've kind of been around various, various environments. This class and this course called Unconsidered Consequences is actually based on an article that I wrote that appeared in the Journal of Financial Service Professionals last July. Actually, it won the Arthur Clark Journal Award as one of the top three articles for the year in the journal. And so that was very gratifying to me. And but there was a reason I wrote it. Several years ago, I went to one of the biggest financial planning seminars in the Midwest. It's called the Midwest Tax and Estate Planning Institute. And at that meeting, there was an attorney, a law professor, nationally recognized speaker, and he talked about funding long-term care expenses with your elder clients. And it was a very thorough presentation, and he talked about Medicaid, he talked about Medicare, thank you, what it does and what it does not cover. Talked about self-funding, talked about health-based long-term care. But nowhere in his presentation did he talk about asset-based or hybrid long-term care insurance. And so I talked to him afterwards and I said, you know, how come you didn't really speak about asset-based long-term care? And he said to me, I know it's out there. I know the market is shifting. I just don't feel I know enough about it to talk about it in the presentation. And then it really hit me. The companies that are in this market that are providing hybrid long-term care do a great job of hitting the sales channels, but we're not doing a good job of hitting the other centers of influence, of hitting elder law attorneys and attorneys that do wealth transfer planning with their clients, of hitting the CPAs that work with the elder population. And so the article, and this is the article I have handed out to you from the journal, was really aimed at educating really attorneys and CPAs on how these products came about, how they work, why they make sense, and why you should be talking with your clients about them. Hence, the title of this presentation, Unconsidered Consequences, the results of failing to have a conversation with your clients about long-term care. Because it's really getting everybody to understand that if you don't plan for long-term care expenses, it's all about dealing with the consequences of that. You know, it's not about the numbers, it's about what do you do when you have the claim and what are the consequences of failing, of having failed to plan for the claim. So let's talk a little bit about what we're going to cover in the presentation. First is the numbers. David McKnight talked about this a little this morning with how, you know, how many baby boomers as a percent of the population and the aging. So by 2025, 253 seniors for every 100 middle-aged Americans. Those over 50 control 75% of the wealth and 50% of the discretionary income. There is a 70% probability for those over 66 that they will need long-term care. 40% needing long-term care between the ages of 64. So not just a problem for the elderly. Cost of care, $92,000 per year, $256 a day is the national average for a private room. $860 per day in Alaska and $169 per day in Louisiana. So it does vary across the country. 70% of singles entering a nursing home are impoverished within 1 year. 50% of couples impoverished within 1 year of the spouse entering the nursing home. So these are the numbers. These are the reality. Like he said today, the four-letter word you can't get away from is math. This is kind of the underlying math behind the issue we're talking about here. But the numbers really aren't important. Anybody who's been out there selling long-term care for any length of time will tell you the numbers are not important. How the consequences of needing long-term care are perceived is what drives clients to have a discussion about long-term care or not have a discussion about it. That gets into how people perceive risk and the fact that people perceive risk differently. Sexists perceive the risk differently. Men separate the risk from the consequence, and it won't happen to them. Hence, it's no consequence. They hear that 70% of people over 66 will need long-term care, and what are they thinking? Not me. That's somebody else. It's not me, right? It's a number. They dispatch it. Right? Women integrate the risk and the consequence. The risk is the consequence for themselves, for their spouses, and their family, right? They start thinking, man, 70%. What happens if I go into a home? What happens to my husband? What happens to me if he goes into a home? What happens to our kids? You got to get the men to think more like the women. And they will, but you have to find out what is the consequence that they're most concerned about, right? Because all important. This really comes from something. How many are familiar with Harley Gordon? Have you ever heard Harley Gordon speak? Any of you? Harley is, he was one of the founders of the National Association of Elder Law Attorneys, NALU. And he speaks nationally, and he speaks a lot about long-term care. And he really gets into how you get people to make a decision to buy coverage. And he's noted over the years that people perceive the risk differently. And it's about getting them to understand the consequence. He'll tell you time and time again, if you go in and lead with product, you aren't going anywhere, right? You have to go in and lead with, there's a consequence for failing to deal with this issue. And if you get the strings properly pulled, then it's a steal. Thinking differently about long-term care. The discussion is not about a series of risks that one faces with age, but rather a discussion about the ability to fulfill financial commitments if care is needed to oneself, one's spouse, and one's family. To the breadwinner to understand, or to the husband to understand, what will happen to your wife as a consequence if you need care. Not that whether or not it'll happen to you, right? But what will be the consequence if that happens? You know, what will be the consequence to the business you want to leave to your children if that happens? Conscience trumps belief creating a plan to protect loved ones. I say appreciating consequences is more important than understanding risk. Now let's talk a little bit about paying for long-term care. See, government benefits, self-funding, and LTC insurance. Government benefits I call other people's money. Self-funding is your money. And LTC insurance is voluntarily shared money. Really, that's what we're talking about. Let's talk about other people's money. Well, if it's other people's money, it always comes with strings. And these are the strings for Medicare. So, you know, and you keep seeing these surveys where the companies will go out and interview, you know, 1,000 people or 2,500 people, you know, at large. And they'll say, well, you know, how do you plan to pay for your long-term care if you encounter it, or who pays for that? And the majority will say, well, Medicare will cover that, because there is a great misunderstanding about what Medicare covers and what it doesn't cover. So Medicare, three-night hospital stay within 30 days of entering a home. You got to enter the nursing home for the same reason as you went in for the hospital stay. It's got to be skilled care, must be rehabilitative. In other words, they have to say you have a chance of having some recovery here, and it's limited to 100 days of coverage. That's per your lifetime, unless you go back for 60 days and you start a new period later on. Now Medicaid. Once you get through the 100 days that Medicare covers, you're on your own. Well, the average length of claim on Medicaid is 2.7 years. So that tells you most people don't go in for 100 days and then die. It doesn't happen, right? So you're going to need to deal with the eventuality of how are you going to cover your long-term care expense once Medicare is done. Well, Medicaid is a means-tested program. It is for the impoverished. So if you're going to a program that is for the impoverished, you have to make yourself appear impoverished. Now, how many people in the course of your life say, my goal in life is to be poor when I'm in retirement, to be... Nah, I don't know anybody who says that. So these are your limits. Income and assets can't be more than $2,000, right? Spousal impoverishment, and this came in, 6, 7, 8 years ago now. that if you have a spouse who is, what they say, in the community, still living at home, and one spouse going into care in a nursing home, that the spouse who is living in the community can have half of the couple's assets up to 241.8. That's the big number. The half max is 129. So what a lot of Medicaid planning attorneys will do with these medium income couples is they'll say, what we want to do is we want to get you as close to that 241 but not over as possible. And when they take that financial snapshot, if you will, determine that number, it's the day the person goes into the skilled care facility and doesn't come out. They create the financial picture of the couple on that date. That's called the snapshot date, and that's what they base the spousal impoverishment on. Yeah. Yes. Right, and the way it works is, let's say you've got a couple, they got $250,000 between them. And remember, there are two tests for Medicaid. There's an asset test and an income test. You count the assets of both, but you only count the income of the person applying, right? So when you're looking at the assets the one applying can have basically is only $2,000. Now, that's of countable assets. There are some assets that they don't count, right? A home that a spouse or dependent is living in is not counted. A car that the spouse is using is not counted, but it's very limited, right? Income-producing property, as long as the income is going to pay for care, is exempt, okay? So there are some things that aren't counted, but of countable assets, right, he can only have two. She can have up to 120, but she can't have more than half of what they had when he went into care and did not come out. So if the day he goes into care, he only has 100,000, or they together only have 100,000 assets, what is her half? It's 50, right? So that's why it's a timing game. And I always say for people, you know, we get into Medicaid, number one, nobody wants to be impoverished, right, and be at the whim of a government program. And like he said today, they're changing the rules all the time because math is going to force them to make eligibility more and more hard to get. Where I was going with that right now, but the whole point is that you have this program where there's so much planning and it's only going to get worse and worse. Back to the 120 and the look period. So we sell across the country, all across the country. And I will tell you, the Medicaid eligibility varies from state to state, and I have seen it vary from county to county. Medicaid is a federal program where the federal government sets the minimums and the general framework of the program, but it is jointly funded by the federal and state government, and it is administered by the states. And so the states really have their own administrative rules. And I have seen, like I say, I have seen that vary from county to county in their health and human services departments. Point I want to make here is you don't want to be on the hook for planning for somebody in the Medicaid arena because there are way too many traps and pratfalls. Leave that to legal counsel, right? I say you don't want to be on the hook for that, and let the attorneys do that. Now, having said that, as we carry on this conversation and I start talking about asset-based long-term care, I'm going to make a point to you about Medicaid planning attorneys. I know a lot of elder attorneys that are basically just Medicaid planners. And all they're interested in doing is qualifying people for Medicaid, converting countable assets into non-countable assets, gifting so they avoid this 5-year look-back rule, maximizing spousal impoverishment, all of this. That's all they do. And if a couple comes in and they're worth $1.5 million, they say to them, well, you can self-insure. I think that is a disservice to that couple. And hopefully by the end of the presentation today, I'll prove it. Okay? So moving on. State recoups benefits paid state liens. Income-producing property is exempt from determining whether somebody's eligible, but when they die, if they still own it, that property's out there, the state will put a lien on it to recover the benefits they paid in their estate. So just beware, and they're doing that more and more. Once again, as it gets more onerous for these state budgets with Medicaid, they're going after more and more property because they can't afford not to. Also, VA, similar to Medicaid, but first of all, they obviously have to be a veteran, hurdle number one, and then that meets service certain criteria. There's a bunch of windows out there that they have to fall into, certain financial criteria that is similar to Medicaid criteria. I will tell you, I'm no expert on VA qualification. I know that it's looser than it is for Medicaid. In other words, they don't have this five-year look back that's so rigidly enforced. But you're limited in types of care, and you've got to be in a VA facility, right? So once again, you have similar limitations that you have to Medicaid, but other people may look at that, the VA benefits as well. So that's other people's money, right? Medicaid, Medicare, VA. Now let's talk about self-funding. And I made this statement about the attorney said to the couple, well, you can self-insure. Really? The liquidation of assets does not pay for care, and it can begin a cycle of increased taxation, exposure to market volatility, and loss of ability to spend on discretionary items. Everybody I ever know says, I have a certain amount set aside, I will liquidate that to cover my care, fails to realize all the risk and how inefficient their distribution pattern is likely to be, because they fail to take all the things into account, like what David McKnight was talking about earlier today, and I'm going to talk about some of that right now. Most will say valued discretionary activities are really non-discretionary spending. This is another thing that actually comes from Harley Gordon, is that when you sit down and talk to people about in their retirement what's discretionary, you find out, he says, there is no such thing as a discretionary expense. Because if I paid for the first seven of my grandchildren to go to college, do I consider paying for number eight discretionary? Probably not. If I've given $10,000 to my church for the past 30 years, do I consider giving to my church discretionary? Probably not, right? You may say, well, that vacation home is something that could be liquidated. Well, what if I own it with my siblings and we inherit it from our parents and we want to pass it to our kids? Is dealing with that discretionary? No. For most people in retirement, what they're spending is what they're spending. There's very little that is truly discretionary. And the couples will say, well, we'll just limit our discretionary spending. Well, when you really get down to look at how much is actually discretionary. Implications of self-funding. Liquidity is the asset really liquid. Obviously, now we know the home the spouse lives in, you're not going to consider liquid, right? But what about the family farm? What about the business? You going to liquidate that if you want to leave it to your kid? No, you won't consider that a liquid asset. The other one is, even if it is liquid, it's a mutual fund, it's stocks, it's bonds, whatever it is, okay? If you have to liquidate them in a down market, obviously, you may get hammered. You think about what happened for those who hit retirement in 2008, or if they had went into long-term care in 2008, and they had to go in and take $100,000 out of their account at the end of the year, how they may have gotten hammered. Remember, the loss of principal means reduced income from that principal. You know, it's an old idea. Let's say I buy stock for $10 a share, and during my life it rises to $30 a share, and I feel pretty good. And then I have a long-term care claim, but when I have the claim, it's dropped from 30 a share to 20 a share. Now I not only have the loss in value and having to sell it when the market's down from the high, but I also have capital gain tax I have to pay because my basis is only $10 a share. So I sell in a down market and I get income taxation to boot. And then income taxation does what? Increases my AGI, which increases my exposure to more taxation, right? So it becomes kind of a vicious cycle. I like these charts here to make a point. When people talk about spending down in retirement, they think of withdrawals as being linear. And it's not. It doesn't really matter if you consider it being linear when you're putting money away for retirement. But it does when you retire. So here's my point. Let's say I'm accumulating and I have $1 million. And let's say these are the rates of return on my $1 million over a 10-year period. And at the end of 10 years, this is my value. This is chart number, this is one rate of return. I end up with 2 million, okay? So over here, I do the same thing. Now, I have different rates of return, but I still have with 2 million, right? Rule of 72, right? 10 years, 7.2% interest, my asset will double, okay? So what I did, you've probably already realized by now, is I just reversed the order, right? I started with 10 down here, started with 0. I just flipped them. The point I'm making is when you're accumulating, it doesn't matter what the rates of return are if you're assuming an overall general rate of return by the time you retire. It doesn't matter the rate at which you experience it. But in retirement, you betcha it matters, right? I did the same thing as I did in the prior chart. I got my rates of return. I just reversed them, okay? I started with $1 million and then said I'm taking out $100,000 a year. Well, under this set, I still have $205,000 left at the end of 10 years. However, under this set, when I have some major losses in the early years, I never recover. I'm out of money by the time I get shortly into year 9. So that's to simply make the point that your rate of return risk matters so much more in retirement because you're in a decumulation phase, right? And if you plan, if you actually plan to be in a decumulation phase, if you say, I'm going to self-insure my long-term care risk, I'm planning to go in and liquidate, then you better be prepared. This is the risk that you're taking. So that's one risk, the decumulation risk, the rate of return risk you have in retirement. There are other implications that fall into this as well. And I loved it with McKnight this morning when he talked about life insurance and you have this wonderful product and everything else create taxes, because I just, everything he said, I absolutely agreed with. I will assert, and I've been asserting this for years, I say there are only 4 tax neutral investment withdrawal activities. 4, that's it. So now I'm going to prove it to you. These are the 4: HSA withdrawals for qualifying medical expenses, long-term care payment for qualifying long-term care, qualified Roth IRA distributions, and cash value life insurance surrenders, switching to basis, switching to loans at basis, okay? That's it. Those are the only 4. And you can say, well, what about municipal bonds? Well, as you talked about this morning, municipal bonds are added back into your income for purposes of provisional income for determining how much of your Social Security benefits are going to be taxed. So muni bonds are not a tax-neutral investment withdrawal activity. Well, you say, what about reverse mortgages? Because the tax code treats reverse mortgages as tax neutral, right? But it's not really an investment withdrawal activity, is it? You're exchanging the home for an income stream. You've lost your ability to freely deal with that property anymore. So it is not an investment withdrawal activity. These are the only 4. Everything else affects the tax return in this way. Let's see. Okay, I want to stay on the screen. Matter of fact, I'll just go right back up here. First thing, ordinary income tax. So think of your IRAs and your qualified plans, right? 401k, all of that. That's ordinary income tax. If I'm planning to liquidate part of my 401k to pay my long-term care expense, I have really now affected my AJI, affected my income, increased maybe the taxation of my Social Security benefits. Let's say I've got a mutual fund, I'm going to liquidate it. Well, I've got capital gains, right? Or if I'm maintaining a fund, I'm pulling off qualified dividends, they're taxed, right? At the capital gain right now, you may see that change in the future too. But right now, you've got that with your capital gains. Provisional income for Social Security, talked about earlier today, that you add back your tax-free bond income, everything, and to determine if you're above $32,000 as a couple, married filing jointly, you start encountering 50% taxation of your Social Security benefits. You get above $44,000, you see as much as 85% of your Social Security benefits being subject to income tax, okay? That increases your AGI. The reason I keep mentioning the increasing AGI is that starts affecting these following things. You've got this 3.8 retirement income surcharge as part of Obamacare. That's the tax they added on wealthy income retirees that said if you get above $250,000 in income, okay, we're gonna start attaching your investment at an additional 3.8%. So now your top tax bracket isn't 39.6, it's 43, right? It's 4%, I can't add, yeah. So that's your top tax bracket. Alternative minimum tax. You know, AMT is something when they enacted it, 1970, it's been so long, it was really targeted at about the top 200 taxpayers in the country. I remember reading an article about a year ago, they said without the patch, the AMT would affect 20 million people. So it's one of these things that just has so grown beyond its scope. The whole point of AMT is it's done to limit the preferences that you get when you fully itemize your return and take advantage of all of your itemized deductions. You start running into AMT taxation normally couples between $100,000 and $400,000 of AGI, depending upon their investments and how they draw from them, will be subject potentially to AMT. Two more are PEP and PEAS. PEP is the personal exemption phase out. You know, it's the gift the government gives us for simply existing, right? On your tax return, we all get a personal exemption. I think this year it's like $1,050, right? So if you take a family of four, mom, pop, two kids, you know, that's $16,200 just for simply breathing. They give us that. Well, but they start taking that away once you start having AGI that's too high. They start reneging on the gift. The same with Pease. It's named after Tom Pease. He was a congressman who decided that we could increase revenue by start limiting certain itemized deductions for taxpayers once they get above a certain level. So you start losing your medical deduction. You start losing your charitable deduction once you get in that. And once again, both of these are in that $100,000 to $400,000 income range. Well, let's say if I have retirement income, Social Security, and pension, whatever, of maybe $50,000. And I say, well, I don't have to worry about AMT or PEP and Pease. And now I have to go in and liquidate $75,000 of my plan or $92,000 of my plan to pay for long-term care expense for my spouse. What have I done to my AGI? I'm now maybe subject. And remember, all of these are based on AGI. When I go to take my medical expense deduction for my long-term care, which is now exceeding 10% of my AGI, my exposure to this isn't affected because that's an after the fact. That's a below-the-line calculation. So let's think about the implications. You know, I say, if you're being forced to sell assets that were designed for intergenerational wealth transfer, it may very well not happen because of all of these factors. And then also, philanthropy. Are the clients being forced to liquidate assets that would want to give to charity? I said earlier, any selling of your principal in retirement is a dollar, you know, principal that's generating less income. Well, the same holds true if you're charitably inclined, right? A dollar less in the portfolio is a dollar less to give to charity, which is a dollar less to decrease your taxes by using a charitable deduction. So once again, it all builds. So going back to this slide right here, I just want to drive home the point that when people say, I have a rate of return imagined, I can, at a reasonable interest rate, I can sustain withdrawal. I guarantee you they're taking absolutely none of this into account. And there's two other things that I haven't even mentioned on this slide, and that's Medicare Part A and Part D surcharges, which can be pretty hefty. If you make above a certain level once you're on Medicare and you're drawing your Medicare and you're paying your Part D Medicare premiums, if you make too much, they double, triple, quadruple your Part B Medicare premiums. And that can get pretty hefty. And what is that? That's another form of tax, right? It's means testing inside of a program that was never meant to be means tested. And it's done because they have to. Once again, it's done because of math. Okay, talk briefly now about long-term care and the two types. Most of us are familiar with health-based long-term care. You know, it appeared most of it around 30 to 40 years ago. Originally, it was like facilities coverage that covered specific events like cancer and stuff like that, and then it broadened out. So I say health-based long-term care coverage is a lot like health insurance. The insurance pays a monthly premium, and when long-term care expenses are incurred, the insurance starts paying. Health-based long-term care insurance has no cash value if the insured never requires LTC, no LTC benefits are paid, and there's no benefit for the insured's heirs. So that's one of the big stumbling blocks and has been in the health-based market is this idea that if you don't use it, you lose it, right? And so in the health-based market, not only do you have that, but where they have sold the policies, you have this conflagration of things that happen that really now prove that the products were underpriced and premiums had to continue. Talk briefly now about asset-based. Asset-based long-term care benefits with either life insurance or a deferred annuity. When long-term care expenses are incurred, the LTC benefits are paid. If long-term care is not needed, or if the policyholder dies, the assets are transferred to the insured heirs. So what we've done now with our asset-based long-term care insurance is we've quelled one of the major buying objections, right? And that is the if I don't use it, I lose it, right? Because if I have a life insurance policy that is prepaying for my long-term care and I never have long-term care, what happens when I die? The death benefit goes to my kids, income tax-free, because it's life insurance. Now, these are some of the issues that I was getting into with the health-based coverage. And you've seen so many carriers get out of the business now. You know, you see the problems that have happened with, you know, some of the carriers going under. And the deal is long-term care insurance is a relative newcomer in the insurance industry. And so it's very hard to judge the claims. And remember, the claims and the cost of long-term care has skyrocketed more than anybody imagined. The other thing that the policy creators and the carriers failed to do was realize that the retention on these policies is going to be nearly 100%. For all of them, it was well over 90%. And if they used lapse-supported pricing, find out their pricing was way too low. Because what happened in the real world is when people would get a notification for a price increase and they pay it for fear of losing all the money that they paid in premium so far. Also, poor investment environment. What's happened with the type of investments the carriers must make to back their guaranteed promises since 2008? That fixed interest rate environment. It's been horrible, right? So where the carriers go for their investment returns, that's been a horrible, horrible place to try to get returns with any types of guarantees. That's hurt them as well. And then I've already talked about the premium increases and the use it or lose it concern. You know, and so what happens with the carriers is they can raise the premium, but they can only do it on a class of policies. They can't do it on any individual insured. It's got to be on a class. And there's also this NAIC requirement that basically says if you want to raise a class premium, you can't do it to be more than what the current premium would be on a new policy. So that's a big limitation, too. Basically, it's put some of them into a box where they're going to lose money and there's no way they can raise the premium fast enough to recover. Now let's talk about life insurance. And I said in the last class I was talking about, you realize life insurance has been around in America for over 150 years. You know, it started as mutual assurance, neighbors insuring neighbors, became the assurance and the fraternal organizations we have today, the industry that we have today. The policies are favored for a reason. When you really think about what life insurance is, it is a hallmark of Western society. It is the voluntary sharing of risk. It's made possible by a lawful society, a society of laws, and a free market economy. It doesn't happen but for that. It is a true gift to us from the country that we live in, okay? And so we should take advantage of it. Having been around so long, actuaries would tell you that we have the mortality of the U.S. population pretty well figured out, okay? And when you think about life insurance, if you plan your policy with no lapse assumptions, in other words, that you're going to pay a claim, and you make the reserve for that, either to pay at 95 on a UL or 100 or 121, whatever framework they hang that policy on, what do you know is going to happen if you have no lapse-supported guessing in your pricing, right? That you're going to have a claim, right? So with your health-based, you may or may not have a claim. With a life insurance, you design your policy, know you're going to have a claim. Your risk now is, what is the risk that claim is simply going to be accelerated? And the actuaries will tell you that's an entirely different calculation and much more judgeable. So you take basically the stability that you have in the pricing arena with life insurance, and you pair that with long-term care to provide stability in the long-term care pricing that you otherwise would not have. So your basic methodology on these asset-based policies is it's basically a prepayment of the death benefit on a permanent life policy for qualifying long-term care claims. Each payment correspondingly reduces the benefit, payments received income tax-free, and the payment of the death benefit, if it's left, if you haven't used it for a long-term care claim, is received income tax-free. So for example, let's say I got $250,000 death benefit, and let's say I have a policy that says it'll pay down at 2% of the face for qualifying long-term care claims. So that would be $5,000. So it would pay up to $5,000 a month for qualified long-term care claims. That would be received income tax-free. Now, if I had a full claim every month for 50 months, what would happen? I would exhaust the policy, right? That $5,000 in month one took my death benefit down to $245,000. Right? So it goes all the way down. So I could exhaust the policy, but I had 50 months of tax-free payments. 50 months, that's over 4 years. the average length of claim on Medicaid is 2.7 years. So you're covering the bulk of claims with your asset-based base policies, just the life policy paying now. Yeah, and so I talk about the relatively stable assumptions. Now, let's talk a little bit about continuation of benefits. Oops. In my example, if I go on claim and I have 50 months of claim and I'm still living, I may be worried, what happens in month 51 now when my coverage has run out? Well, I can buy with these carriers additional coverage called continuation of benefits coverage. Most companies will simply underwrite it and charge you an additional premium for it, okay? But you can buy up to lifetime coverage with some carriers, okay? Now, I see here the concept of a large deductible, the outlying claim, and essentially using the insurance money first. What do I mean by that? The company I work for, One America, one of the companies that we own is State Life. And State Life has a series of products that are called the Care Solutions product line. And it's all asset-based long-term care. And they're one of the major players in the market. And we acquired that product line actually from Golden Rule, if anybody remembers Golden Rule from years ago. Golden Rule had their product line with life and asset-based products. And they had a health line. The health line was bought by United Healthcare, and One America purchased this product line. So even though I've been with the company for 25 years, I've been working with this product line for about 12 years. And I will tell you, the more I get involved with it, the more efficient I believe that it is. And I remember looking at pricing on my own life for lifetime coverage on a $250,000 policy, and I looked at the chief actuary and I said, I don't believe you can cover me at $5,000 a month for this amount. And he said, I said, well, you're going to break the coverage, you know, going to break the company with this type of coverage. He says, no. He says, there's nothing here that is magical. There's no actuarial alchemy going on here. Then when you think about it, the average claim on Medicaid is 2.7 years. So you got that covered with the base policy. If you go out and buy car insurance, and you've got a choice between $100 deductible and $1,000 deductible, you'll see what? A material difference in the premium, right? And we understand that because after $101, the carrier's paying over here. But on $1,000, I'm paying the first $1,000. Their coverage has been much later. It's more of an outlying claim. When you think about this asset-based long-term care, during that base policy period, whose money are you using? The insurance, right? It's in essence the client's money. The risk was we're pricing what is the risk that the claim, the death benefit is going to be prepaid. But it's the insurance money. It's the insurance policy. So what we're covering is the outlying claim. And once again, the actuaries will tell you that's a different type of calculation. You know, they talk about running tails and annuity tails and things like that. And they get the language, you know. It's like the actuaries in a balloon, right? And a big wind gust comes up not the actuary, the attorney. We'll make it the attorney. The attorney's in a balloon, and the wind blows the balloon way off course. And finally, it gets close to the ground, and the attorney looks out of the balloon, and he sees somebody on the ground. He says, can you tell me where I am? And the guy says, yeah, you're 100 feet above the ground in a hot air balloon. And the attorney says, you're an actuary. And the guy on the ground goes, how did you know? And the attorney says, because what you told me was completely accurate and totally worthless, right? So sometimes in my conversations with the actuaries, they can drive it home to my mind about efficiency. You know, using the example of the insurance deductible and using people's money first and covering the outlying claim. So what we have done basically is we use the stability and pricing of life insurance, and we're using that to leverage maximum to our benefit to get lifetime coverage for people. And it's like I said, it's all about efficiency. So I say in essence, asset-based LTC policies with continuation of benefits combine the stable pricing and tax efficiency of the base policies with the concept of a large deductible, provide up to lifetime coverage for claims in the most efficient and risk-minimizing manner currently available. This is additionally accomplished without the use of the loser quandary present with health-based LTC. Now, it's the same with annuities, except obviously with a deferred annuity, you don't have the tax-free death benefit. So They provided for hybrid life insurance and long-term care in the 1996 Tax Act in HIPAA, when they defined what qualified long-term care was. And then 10 years later in 2006, they extended that to say you can pair annuities and long-term care together as well. Get a lot of money at our company, and I think all the carriers are getting it from 1035 exchanges. So you know a lot of people that have cash value life insurance that has gain into it as they hit retirement, or they have deferred annuities with gain in it as they hit retirement, and they're concerned about long-term care. You can 1035 exchange those policies. You can go this way, but you can't go back. So obviously you can go life to life, life to endowment, life to annuity, and life to straight long-term care, but you can't go, for example, from an annuity back to life. But with the annuity products now, once again, you can take money and go into an annuity LTC product. And the nice thing about that, if I've got an annuity out there, deferred annuity with 100,000 a basis, and over the life of the contract, it's grown to 200,000, I got 200,000, now I got 100,000 a gain. If I buy my LTC contract, annuity contract with that, and I use all that money for long-term care, I will never have paid any income tax on it. Zero. I've wiped out the tax consequence on that deferred annuity. Now, if I die with that annuity intact and I haven't paid a claim, my kids get it, it gets the same tax treatment any annuity gets, that gain my kids will pay tax on. But like I say, that's no different than had I left it in any annuity, and what I did in the interim is I covered my long-term care risk. There's this long-term care, I'm not going to talk a lot about this, but and I talked in the last meeting about providing long-term care in the business setting, so I'm not going to hit that here. But I just will tell you, this is what I want you to take from this chart. They say, oh, your long-term care premiums are deductible. Well, for the individual taxpayer, that's really not true. There's three things that make it really not true. The first one is 50% of your retirees, over 50%, don't itemize. So they're not going to get that deduction anyway because it's an itemized deduction. Second is your medical deduction on your itemized Schedule A is subject to a 10% of adjusted gross income floor. So you really have to already have some type of catastrophic medical expense before you get to the point where you're going to be able to deduct anything. And even if you're at that point, then you're limited by this age-related table for premiums at these given ages where, you know, if you're 52 years old, the maximum you can deduct this year is $1,530. So you may not be single paying that and expecting a deduction, or if you are, realizing you're not going to get a deduction for the whole premium on your long-term care. This is another question I get. Let me go back. Most carriers now are offering your regular life insurance, and they have what they call a chronic illness and a terminal care rider on it. A lot of them are, most of them actually, are providing it without any charge. And they say, well, this is as good as long-term care. Well, I think it's a valuable benefit. My company offers all these terminal illness critical care as well. But if you're really talking about covering long-term care risk, my advice is go out and buy the hybrid long-term care policy. First, you get more protection for the client with long-term care. To sell long-term care, you got to be long-term care licensed. You've got your LTC continuing ed, and the consumer has more protection. Most states require the provision, you know, of the consumer buying guide for long-term care. But these other things, these are the most important. Most carriers with their accelerated death benefit rider for terminal illness will say that it maxes out at 50. I've seen some at 75%. So they're not going to get the face amount anyway of the policy to use for long-term care. And the other thing is the younger you are, they will discount that amount by your age. So it might be a 50% benefit you'll get of the policy face if you're 60 years old, but maybe it's only 40 or 30 or 20% if you're at 40 when you go on claim. So you don't know what the full coverage is until you actually have a claim. Whereas with these hybrid policies, on all the carriers, the coverage is the face. You're paying down from the face. So you know at a minimum what the coverage is when you buy the policy at issue. And the other thing is, if you want up to lifetime coverage, you can only get that with these hybrid products because that's the only place you can go and buy the continuation of benefits product. I will simply tell you this in providing long-term care as an executive benefit. We're seeing more and more cases that are bonus cases. I don't think there's anybody left in that group long-term care market now, the workplace market. They've all left. This is the straight health-based market. But you still have employers who want to provide long-term care to key employees. And so the question is, can you do that with these hybrid products? And the answer is yeah. you know, and it's the basic bonus plan. You know, the 162 bonus where the employer pays the premium on the policy that the employee owns. The base premium is deducted as compensation by the employer, reported income as compensation paid by the employee. But the real sizzle comes in if you buy continuation of benefits coverage, because that is all long-term care. And that is now deductible as an employer-provided medical expense. So, and where it really gets real sizzle is with C-corporations. C-corporation owner employees where they have retained earnings in the C-corporation can deduct continuation of benefits coverage without limit. The corporation gets to deduct it, and they report none of it in income. The biggest case we've had, I think, at State Life this year, it was four siblings and a friend who was a company CFO. They covered the siblings and their wives, maximum coverage. They bought maximum continuation of benefits coverage, the inflation riders, all of it. Total premium in the case was like $2.7 million. 1.3 of it was deductible, because that was what they were putting in to the continuation of benefits coverage. So if you run into that situation where you've got employers looking for a way to leverage retained earnings out of a C corp, it's one thing you can think, is where else can you go? Qualified plan's about the only other area, right? And other than that, and here you can discriminate with this coverage where you can't with the qualified plan. So just bear that in mind. Oh, what did I do? Okay, I say, what type of client are you advising? So one of the big things now in a lot of carriers and their selling system is, when do you hit people as they age and really start thinking about retirement? When is too early? 20, 30, 40, 50, you know? Like he said this morning, McKnight, you just can't be 66 and take that IRA that's worth $250,000 and convert it to a Roth, because you got these onerous income tax consequences. You need to do something like that piecemeal over time. So I really think where that begins is probably somewhere around 50 years of age. When you meet clients 45, 50, 55 years of age, they really need to start thinking about what the character of income is that they're going to have in retirement. It's not about going to a number, you know, what's your number, you know, and it's not all about rate of return, what you're going to get. It is, what is the character of the income that you want to have in retirement? So how much money are you going to lose to government, right? How inefficient is your distribution pattern going to be when you retirement? So, you know, you hear about the zero tax plan. You see my comment about there are only four tax neutral investments. I really think with your clients that are approaching these ages, you really need to be thinking about maximizing what they put into their cash value life insurance, maximizing what their annual contributions are, what their conversions are to Roth without going into a higher marginal bracket, maximizing their use of HSA plans, and thinking about asset-based long-term care, because that will make a huge difference in retirement. I've got a course I teach where I actually go into tax calculation and case examples. It really gets into the accounting and the weeds real quick. But there's one example where I have a couple where they're making, I forget what they're making, around $200,000 a year in retirement. And I say now they need to go in and take an extra $100,000. And the assets that one couple has, it's all life insurance, it's Roth IRAs, you know, and so they go into that for their long-term care expense. And the other couple, it's all qualified money, and they have to go into qualified money. And in this one example I run, on a $100,000 additional, the difference in taxes is $42,000. Because remember, it's not about what the marginal rate is, we said earlier today, it's about, really the question is, what is the tax on the next dollar spent? Because your retirees, you know, I said there's no such thing as discretionary income. You're going to be spending that money anyway for living, right? What you have, you know, you pay for utilities and home and groceries and eating. When you go into that extra money, that's at the top. You know, we told, it was the beaker. What was that called? The graduated cylinder? You know, it's that graduated cylinder. When you go in to pay that long-term care claim, that's at the very top. It's the tax on the next dollar spent. And once again, when people become subject to all these extra things, the PEP and the P's and the AMT and the surcharges on the Medicare premiums and the Obamacare tax and all of that, I agree with what was said earlier today. It is not fair to assume that you will not be in a higher tax bracket at retirement. you know, when I started 25 years ago, I think it was fair to say, yeah, you can assume they might be in a lower tax bracket retirement. I don't think it's fair to say that anymore. I don't think it can be fair, once again, because he said math. And I think I do agree with that. So anyway, hope I opened your eyes to an opportunity to deal with clients and their centers of influence. Like I say, the article in front of you is really aimed at CPAs and attorneys. And back to my comment earlier, and I'll just close with this, about doing a disservice. If you can get their other centers of influence to understand the consequences of not having a conversation about long-term care, and then get them to understand at least the efficiency of the solution that we're providing, then I think you can go a long way for helping out your clients and working well in that market. Oh, it's already imploded. I think it will die the death, it will continue the death spiral that it's currently in. Yeah, yeah. That's what I mean. Oh, well, most of the carriers will provide additional coverage. For example, well, Ken, you know ours far better than I do. But they'll cover in-home care. They'll cover the most care, you know, they'll cover the, it's, they go far beyond what the bare minimum of Section 7702 is. But they'll pay for in-home care for licensed, you know, skilled care people to come in and care, and LPNs and things like that. Yeah, yeah. So, well, anyway, I hope it's proved beneficial. Once again, I thank you for your time, and I hope it's been worthwhile.